This is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. The campaigns are over. Some races were contentious, some were unopposed, but for all the Election Day winners, it comes time now to govern. For David Price, it will be nothing new. North Carolina's elected representative from the 4th District enters his 16th year in Congress. That experience has provided him with enough knowledge and wisdom to write three editions of a book called The Congressional Experience, Transforming American Politics. He joined us today to talk about that experience of being a member of Congress. Welcome, Congressman Price.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We're also going to be taking your calls this hour at 1-877-962-9862. And later in the program, we'll be speaking with Republican Patrick McHenry, newly elected congressman from the 10th District of North Carolina. He'll be soon experiencing his first few days on Capitol Hill. Your first few days were back in 1987, Congressman Price. Do you remember those days?
I certainly do. It was a very exciting time. We were welcomed to Congress. We had more in the way of orientation and briefings than we could possibly digest. We went off to the Kennedy School up at Harvard University on a bipartisan basis, the new freshman class, to receive yet more briefings on the issues of the day. And we were soon thrust into the internal politics of the Congress. We had just come out of our own political fights in our districts, but I recount in this book about the electing of a new speaker and the kind of contested committee chairmanship races that I had to deal with immediately without knowing much about them, and also looking out for ourselves, trying to get good committee assignments, trying to position ourselves to be effective in the institution. All that was thrust on us in a matter of weeks, and we had to somehow pick our way through it.
It's pretty daunting stuff and heady stuff. I mean, here you are, you're elected, you've run for this office, you've sought it, and I would presume once you get there and you realize you are a tangible part of American and world history, the landscape looks a little different.
It is an awesome experience. There are a lot of things to bring you down to earth pretty fast in terms of practical things you need to do to get your office organized. I recount here in the book one thing that brought me down to earth real fast. I was trying to get an office picked and to get what was already a cubic yard of mail answered that was just waiting for me when I got there. And there were a couple of issues that had generated hundreds of letters. One was the application of Raleigh-Durham Airlines for an international route. Another was the something having to do with the Sharon Harris nuclear power plant. And there were so many of those letters that we thought, you know, we really need to get an outside mail house to help us answer those before we're fully set up. So I drafted responses. The only trouble was the outside mail house reversed the two lists. So everybody that wrote about the nuclear power plant got an RDU airport letter and vice versa. So that was my initiation to congressional mail, and I couldn't have been happier than to get in my own office and have a little more control over the situation a few weeks later.
I'm sure you mentioned that this is the third edition of this book. You had the original edition, then you updated it 8 years later. This time you waited only 4 years, and you say, but bringing the story forward has been no less challenging, for those 4 years have seen portentous changes in our country's fiscal and foreign policies and in the context of congressional service. How has it changed?
It's changed in many, many ways, and I guess partly what I'm saying there is that it's a pretty difficult thing to find the chunks of time needed to write a serious book in the middle of congressional experience, no matter how you're doing it. But I did feel like the past 4 years had been very important years with a lot of changes, and that I really needed to go ahead and do a third edition and not wait 8 years like I did for the second edition. What I'm referring to there is, of course, the years of the George W. Bush administration, which have brought amazing changes in our country's fiscal situation and in our diplomatic situation. In both cases, I think, not changes for the better for the most part.
Have we become pure, true isolationists under this administration?
No, I wouldn't say that, but I would say that we have suffered a diplomatic a loss of our diplomatic prestige and respect in large parts of the world. And that is tied, I think, not to the post 9/11 response, which I think the world was with us on, and we had a broad international consensus on going after the Taliban, going after al-Qaeda, the post 9/11 operations. What has divided the international community and given us great diplomatic problems is the declaration of a unilateral approach, preemptive, preventive wars, the not just going to war in Iraq, but the way we went to war in Iraq, largely without our main allies and without a convincing post-war plan, and it turns out with faulty intelligence. That's been a very, very divisive operation for this country. As I say, not just deposing Saddam Hussein. Lots of people thought that should have been done, or at least he should have been contained and controlled in a effective way. But the way we went to war, the way we've pursued a largely unilateral approach to foreign policy has given us great diplomatic difficulties. And then on the fiscal side, we've had a $9 trillion reversal, going from $5.5 trillion in projected surpluses over the next 10 years to $3.5 trillion in additional debt. Some of that was inevitable, a result of a slow economy and of our security needs, but some of it counts as self-inflicted damage. And so, yes, there's been a lot of change in both our fiscal and our diplomatic situation. And then when I talk about the context of congressional service, I'm talking about not just life in the minority, but life under this leadership, which has represented a kind of tightening up of the way the House is run and an increasingly difficult situation, not just for Democrats, but actually for a lot of members of the majority party, a very centralized, often hard-edged operation.
Your wife has described your writing this book as, quote, an improbable undertaking. What does she mean?
Well, when she first, I don't know, that may be my terminology and not hers. I'm not sure she would say that. But I certainly realized that was her attitude, and it should have been, because the second edition of this in particular was really hard to write. It was after 8 years. A lot of things had changed. I had lost one election and had a comeback. The Gingrich Revolution, so-called, had taken place in the House. The Clinton presidency had almost come and gone. So there was a lot to write about, and we were in the process of moving across town to a new house and had lots of things complicating our lives. So it's hard, under the best of circumstances, to find chunks of time to do serious writing. I'm not the sort of person who can just sit down on the airplane and take advantage of 30 minutes and write out a few coherent paragraphs. I do need some chunks of time, and that's so it is improbable, I would say, in the midst of congressional service to do this. On the other hand, I have felt it was important to do, and it's a way of blending my own background and expertise as a political scientist with my work now as a active practicing politician and trying to bring those worlds into some kind of contact that's useful for students to understand, and I hope useful and interesting also to the broader public.
Go back to 1994 for just a moment. I had just arrived in this market to work maybe 6 months prior to the election. And the night that Fred Heineman won that race by, it was less than 2,000 votes.
Yes, something like 1,200 votes or so, yeah.
You thought you were going to win that race. I presume you felt good. You knew it'd be tight. The Republicans were active. They were getting out their vote. When that night was over and you realized, or when the point came that you realized that this seat was gone, at least for 2 years, what was that like?
Oh, well, it was very difficult. It was actually not totally a surprise. It was a surprise to a lot of my friends and supporters.
They were stunned.
And it was considered an upset, certainly. But as I say in this book, and as I have a couple of newspaper citations to prove, this was something that didn't totally just sneak up on us. I mean, we realized it was an unusual political year. The political terrain really shifted. The agenda of these talk show hosts seemed to almost become the general public agenda. People would come in highly influenced by Rush Limbaugh and others like him. In this district, which had always had education as its top issue and had a rather low crime rate and a rather optimistic outlook. All of a sudden, people became much more pessimistic. They said crime was their number one issue. That had never even been in the top five before. And here I had my best-known opponent, a former police chief, on the other side. So it was a situation that gave me great concern. I campaigned as hard as I knew how personally. In retrospect, we probably should have started earlier to do television advertising and some other things. But we ended up on the short end of that vote, and I had a lot of thinking to do to understand the outcome, to think about what my own options were, and actually I fairly quickly decided that I should attempt a comeback, and so within a few months we had made that decision.
And you've been back ever since. This is The State of Things. We're talking today with Congressman David Price about his book, The Congressional Experience. Congressman Price represents North Carolina's 4th Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives. And we'd like to hear from you at 1-877-962-9862. Congressman Price will answer your questions. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. We're talking today about the congressional experience. Congressman David Price enters his 16th year as the representative from North Carolina's 4th District. He's also the author of the book, The Congressional Experience, Transforming American Politics, and he's just updated this book.
Actually,
it's a great textbook for civics.
Yeah, well, it's usually used as a parallel text for courses on Congress and American politics in universities. It also has, of course, some more general interest. The Transforming American Politics, actually, that sounds a little pretentious. That's the name of the series that this is part of. It's not part of the title of the book.
Well, on page 71 in this book, there's a listing of a typical member's daily schedule. And on one day, it points out Tuesday, March 30th, began with Homeland Security Appropriations Subcommittee hearing. Then there's meeting, meet, ends with a reception. I mean, it's not exactly like members of Congress work short hours.
No, that's why I reprinted this here. I thought it would give the flavor for the time we're in Washington, which is approximately half the time. We have usually a three and a half day work week, and then we're back in the district here with a pretty busy schedule here too. But this series of meetings, this is in March of the year, which is when everybody's coming up to Washington to talk, and a lot of this has the flavor of appropriations. That's my committee assignment, so people are particularly concerned about their funding needs. But this is a pretty good list. The Parkinson's Disease Advocates Group, the Soybean Growers Association, the North Carolina members of the CWA, the Communications Workers Union, representatives of the Medical Society here in the state. That's just a small sample, but we do a lot of that, and we don't have to do it in Washington. You know, people can talk to us here anytime they want to, but often these groups have national meetings in Washington, and they'll work in a visit to their congressman while they're up there.
We're going to take a call in just a moment, but first, I know you have great support staff, and every member of Congress pays very close attention to the type of people they bring on staff, field reps, people to work. However, how difficult is it to focus? I mean, you have to go from one meeting to another, to another, to another, try to grasp what's going on, take it, internalize it, know what to do with it, and it changes. It can change drastically from group to group.
That's one interesting thing about the job. I mean, there is great variety to it, and it's also a huge contrast between work here at home in the district and work in Washington. It's a bifurcated existence personally, but it's also here at home, you know, you're a local politician. You're visiting with local groups. You're dealing with their needs. A lot of occasions that people want you to be a part of. And then in Washington, you're one small cog in the machine making national policy. So it does have a lot of variety. That staffing is an important part of it. I'm fortunate in having a very competent chief of staff in Washington and a district manager and staff here. About 16, 17 people normally, pretty much equally divided between Washington and, in my case, three district offices in Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill.
We have Kate calling us on the line here from Greenville. Kate?
Hi. It's a real pleasure. I would like to ask Representative Price if the Democratic Party nationally, as well as the Democratic Party in North Carolina, really understands how upset a lot of the Democrats are, and want to, we want the power to come back to the people. We're tired of, where before we were not interested particularly in who the leadership was in the DNC, et cetera. We're very interested now. And I wonder if this message is getting through.
Oh, I think so. Election we've just been through was like none other I've ever experienced in terms of the grassroots mobilization. And obviously, there was a lot of mobilization on both sides. But here in the Triangle area, I've never seen anything like it. The extent to which students were involved, people were coming in on weekends to canvass their neighborhoods to help with the election. People felt very passionately about this election, and I think for good reason. I think it was a great outpouring of democracy, though, and that was inspiring, and it's not something that will stop or should stop now that the election's over. I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to in terms of the choices that might face the National Committee. I'm going to be a part of a commission that looks at the presidential nominating process on behalf of the Democratic National Committee. Alexis Herman, the former Labor Secretary, and I will be the co-chairs of that effort. And one of our jobs will be to take a look at the way we nominate the president, to try to make certain that there's opportunities for participation in a wide spectrum, and also a sensible process that's well-paced, so that not one or two states, it's not dominated by one or two states, but that it lasts over a number of weeks and gives us a chance to have a second look at candidates and ultimately to make the strongest choice. So I hope that that commission will help us figure out new ways to enhance participation and make the large-D Democratic Party more small-D Democratic.
Kate, thanks for your call this afternoon. I'd like to mention Ed Turlington, who the governor has said is his choice to become the next chairperson of the State Democratic Party, is also a member of that committee.
Yes, he is. Ed's going to be a very valuable member, I think. He's a seasoned party activist and really will bring a lot to the table, I believe.
When John Kerry and John Edwards lost this race, I mean, obviously, it's a disappointment to you as a North Carolinian, as a Democrat. Were you depressed over it? We've heard some people, I don't mean deep clinical depression, but was it a down time for you initially when you found out that they had lost the race?
Yes, it was disappointing because I thought, for reasons we referred to earlier, the magnitude of some of the problems that we're facing, some of them self-created, I think, by the leadership we have now in terms of our diplomacy, in terms of our fiscal situation, and many, many other things that our country needs to be attending to. I thought it was a time for a change, and I thought John Kerry and John Edwards made a compelling case for change. Now, was the campaign perfect from my point of view? Would I have done it just that way? No, and I think nobody would say that they wouldn't have some second thoughts and some criticisms, but basically I thought the case for change was very strong, and a bare majority of the American people, of course, didn't feel that way, and so now we're going to try to make the best of a situation where the Bush administration has another round.
Congressman Price, we're going to be talking with Congressman-elect Patrick McHenry here in just a moment, who will serve in the United States House of Representatives as the youngest member of the House, but he's in the majority party. You're going back to Congress for your 16th year.
Actually, 17th. I'm just finishing my 16th. That's right.
17th year as a member of the minority party. Will he have an advantage over you, even though you're a veteran?
Well, he will in some respects, and in other respects, he won't. I did come to Congress. I was not as young as Patrick. I had a career in teaching and in political involvement, so I was in my mid-40s when I came to the Congress.
And, young man.
A young man. But looks younger all the time, doesn't he? but There's a big difference between being in the majority and being in the minority.
And there's a different feel on Capitol Hill than there was.
Well, there is. And I think even for members of the majority party now, with the kind of leadership that they have, there's a kind of discipline that's required that, you know, it's not all bad. I think we need disciplined parties to run the Congress well and to let the majority ultimately rule. But I do think, as I detail in the book, I think some of the tactics of this particular majority have not just produced party discipline, but they've actually undermined the bipartisan capacity that we need from time to time to deal with the vexing issues that one party usually can't take on alone. But yes, I'm in a situation now in the minority. I have some advantages, though, by virtue of experience and also my committee placement. If I were picking a committee that I would want to be on as a minority member, I would pick the one I am on, which is Appropriations, which, although it has suffered some erosion in its capacities by virtue of this pervasive partisanship, really has remained a fairly cooperative and fairly bipartisan committee. It's one I'm able to operate effectively on. So as a minority member, I'm particularly grateful to be there.
Patrick McHenry is joining us now by phone. Representative-elect McHenry, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, David.
You've been listening to this conversation. Do you take what Congressman Price has been saying as words of wisdom?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Congressman Price has served admirably and in his 16 years in Congress, and I'm looking forward to serving with him, looking forward to actually reading your book as well, Congressman Price.
Well, if you need something to help you doze off at night, might be a good prescription. Actually, I hope you'll find it interesting. You'll find that it does have a point of view. It's not it's not a plain vanilla book. On the other hand, I hope it is fair. I hope it's objective and useful to people, regardless of exactly what political viewpoint they're bringing to it.
Absolutely.
Representative McHenry, I know you've had some experience in Washington. However, you will be headed there in January as one of 435 elected representatives to represent not only the 10th District of North Carolina, but a representative of the United States. How daunting does this appear to you so far?
Well, any task of this magnitude is daunting. To begin with, there's so much in order just to get your office established that I don't believe it's quite hit me yet. And I don't know if it will be when I'm actually sworn in on the floor of the House. But since the election, you know, I've had a long 13 months of campaigning. And so right after the election day, we immediately went into hiring staff and finding office space and reaching out to get committee assignments and things of that sort.
And what committees are you looking for?
Well, you know, Congressman Price is in a much different boat than I'm in. He's on the Appropriations Committee, and that's pretty substantial, whether you're in the, as Congressman Price said, either in the majority party or the minority party. So he's got an enormous amount of power that he is able to wield from that position. The best committee assignment I could hope to receive as a freshman this term would be financial services, which regulates the banking industry, Wall Street, and the insurance industry as well, and some others, but mainly those three industries. And as North Carolina is the second leading banking center in the nation, you know, I think we need to have a larger voice on that committee.
Do you think you'll get it?
It's a long shot. It's going to be a difficult road to hoe because it's a committee that is sought after by, I believe, 2/3 of the Republican freshmen are asking for it. So I've got to make the case, and I think I can make the case. Otherwise, you know, education workforce would be a good committee. Government reform, small business, things of that sort would be good as well.
It's got to be a little tough to get your feet on the ground and get your sea legs when you get to Congress. And with that in mind, I would presume that constituent service would be dominating what's going to be happening in your office more than legislation. Is that a fair presumption?
That is a fair presumption for the first term. You want to make sure that you establish good relationships with all your local officials. Congressman Price has a good constituent operation from all the things I've heard. But after doing it for 16 years, you have a proficiency for it, so you don't have to spend as much time in order to have as much impact. And so in that regard, I'll have to spend much more time to have an impact that I can have in half the time in my second term. So I want to get the organization in place. I want to get my staff trained. I want to make sure that we have offices in the proper location, people reaching out to the community and things of that sort. So there's a lot of starting up work that you have to do in your first term that Congressman Price, in his now going into the 17th mm-hmm. year, doesn't have to worry about putting a constituent service operation in place because he's been doing it.
Everything sounds so congenial. Now, I'd like to know, as a member of Congress, David Price, is it sort of like attorneys that we see battling in the courtroom, but once they leave the courtroom, they often go and have drinks together, and they share experiences and talk about things. We see the contentiousness on the floor of the House or played out in the media as we are there with our cameras and microphones and notepads ready to document everything. But at the end of the day, are you true colleagues in the best sense of the word?
Many people are, including me. I have many friends across the aisle and value those friendships. amount of contact, though, with other members and their families is not as much as it was in past years. This schedule that we were talking about earlier, where airline travel and the expectations of constituents back home dictate that we get out of town pretty much, out of Washington, pretty much after the last vote is held the week. That's very different from the old days. People who were in Congress a couple of generations ago will tell you about having their families there in D.C. and often being there on weekends, socializing across party lines and across regional lines and really getting to know their colleagues in a way that's much harder now. And I guess I'd also say there's been some deterioration of relationships across party lines with the kind of hard edge that partisan combat has sometimes taken.
Did that begin with the Gingrich years?
I think Newt Gingrich brought a big change to the tone of the Congress, and I think Republican members would agree with that. The kind of leadership that they had before was they were tough. Bob Michael and Republican leaders in those years could wage a good fight, but with Gingrich it got more personal, it got more anti-institutional. There was a lot of bashing of Congress as an institution, and a use of the words like illegitimate, corrupt, kind of questioning people's motives, questioning even their patriotism, and so there was a hard edge to party relations that developed during that Gingrich period. And of course, from one point of view, it worked for Newt Gingrich and his cohorts. They managed to take over the House in 1994. On the basis of a very harsh institutional critique. Some of that they changed. We were talking before we went on the air about the term limits crusade. Term limits crusade all of a sudden became a lot less urgent once Republicans were in charge.
It's amazing how that texture changes. Patrick McHenry, when you hear this, are you going to take a pair of shin guards with you or a suit of armor?
Well, look, I've served in the North Carolina State House, and we had 60 Republicans and 60 Democrats. We had fierce partisanship, even among Republicans. We had this sort of internal family feud.
But aren't the stakes a little higher in Washington?
The stakes are a little bit higher. I don't think it can get any more personal than it was in the State House, though. So I've been sort of tempered by that fire already, and
plus,
I'm prepared.
Your primary battle wasn't exactly the easiest of politicians.
No, my primary opponent attacked me like I've never seen before. He had all these wonderful accusations, very wild accusations. One which was the most dumbfounding was that I had wild all night parties. This was one of his attacks. Very bizarre. So having weathered this year, I think it can all only get easier from here. But what's interesting about the partisanship in the House...
Hold that thought for me, if you would. We need to take a break, Mr. McHenry. We'll be back with you. We'll talk about partisanship and what's expected of those who are elected to serve in Washington. We're talking about life as a U.S. congressman. David Price is here. He is the 9-term Democratic congressman representing North Carolina's 4th Congressional District. Patrick McHenry also with us. He is the Republican congressman-elect from North Carolina's 10th District. He follows fellow Republican Cass Ballinger, who retired after 9 terms in Congress. Just ahead, more of your calls at 1-877-962-9862 on the state of things. This is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. We're talking this hour about life as a U.S. congressman from North Carolina, its ups and downs, challenges, and disappointments. We have the perspective of Congressman David Price, the 9-term Democrat who's from the state's 4th District, and Patrick McHenry, a Republican from Gaston County, who was just elected to Congress from North Carolina's 10th District. And we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Just before the break, we heard the term partisanship come up again. And Patrick McHenry, before we get back to you, Congressman Price has lived through a lot of partisanship battles, and a central question has got to be, all conflict is not necessarily always bad.
No, it certainly isn't. We wouldn't expect to always agree in a country as diverse as this one, with 435 strong-willed people representing varied kinds of districts. And the way we organize that debate and that conflict is with parties. And so a chamber like the U.S. House needs strong, disciplined parties. And that was recognized on the Democratic side many, many years ago as we strengthened the hand of our leadership and strengthened our own caucus. And when the Republicans came in 1994, they took that a step further and centralized power to an extent that I think Democrats would not have found serviceable. But it's the way they chose to run their caucus. I have no objection to strong parties. I think our system depends on them, and I have worked on among our Democratic colleagues to strengthen our party discipline. But what I'm trying to say in the book, and what I do feel very strongly, is that Congress doesn't just need a capacity for the majority to rule through the majority party. Congress also, on a whole range of issues, needs a capacity to act in a bipartisan way. Take trade, for example. There's a hardcore anti-trade faction within both parties. So you're not going to pass any trade agreements without a bipartisan coalition. And the same's true, I think, of dealing with difficult issues like Social Security and Medicare. So what worries me about the current partisan tactics, where rules that govern floor debate, for example, don't even allow the offering of Democratic alternatives. And where, for example, one of our chairmen of a House-Senate conference said he would shut the conference down if Democrats so much as came to the meeting. You know, that sort of thing erodes our bipartisan capacity to act when we need to act. And that, I think, is an ominous development.
Patrick McHenry, let's get your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, there's a different notion. You know, when Democrats had a 100-seat majority in the U.S. House, it was much easier for them to say, sure, Republican minority, offer whatever amendment you'd like, because we'll crush you anyway. And what's happened is as the margins have narrowed between Republicans and Democrats, and then once Republicans got in the majority, we've had the slimmest of majorities in the last decade. It's even... Some would regard the majority so slim that it's almost not workable. You know, it's akin to having a one-vote or two-vote majority in the North Carolina House, the majorities that Republicans have had. And as such, partisanship has increased because, you know, the minority can almost taste power because they're so close.
You know, sometimes as a person who views this from the outside, it appears that it's more about winning than it is about governing.
Well, no, it's a you know, the majority party, or, you know, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, you want to implement your philosophy and your policies. And as such, you know, the stakes are high. Stakes are very high, you know, when Republicans are pushing for tax cuts and, supporting President Bush on the war on terror, for instance. You know, the stakes are so high in Washington, D.C., as you said at the beginning of this interview, David, that it gets more partisan because there's so much more at risk and at play.
Let's go to the phones and talk with Gene in Raleigh. Gene?
Hi there. I'm curious to know, I've been a long-time supporter of David Price. I can't vote for him anymore because of redistricting, but a lot of us out here nonetheless have supported him because we feel he's been one of the most effective and articulate congresspeople we have. I would like to know from David what his take is on the primary reason why the Democrats lost the presidential election. I have my own theory about it, but I'd love to hear his.
Okay, well, listen. Thank you, Gene.
Well, as someone who's been in some close elections, I know very well that in a very close election, you can pick lots of things that made a big difference and potentially the decisive difference. But it seems to me that the overriding factor in this election, just as it was in 2002, was the post 9/11 mindset of the American people, where the security issue and the terrorism issue come to override what you might call normal or usual partisan concerns. Now, in my opinion, of course, that was not a decisive reason for voting to give George W. Bush another 4 years in power. But I do believe that for a critical fraction of the voters, they did see it that way, and that's what won the election. The political scientists who have looked at the 2002 election say that easily, if it had not been for 9/11 and the terrorism issue, that Democrats would have won back the House in 2002, that it simply overrode the normal considerations. And the question going into the 2004 election was whether this would be another security-dominated election. And it was enough that way to tip the balance toward George W. Bush. There are other things, of course, that came into play, but I think that's the overriding one.
Patrick McHenry, from your perspective, why did President Bush win re-election?
Well, I think he laid out a clear philosophy and a clear agenda for governing. John Kerry was all over the map. He was a liberal, then he was a conservative, then he was, he was all over the map and didn't really articulate a clear message. And President Bush has been resolute when it comes to the war on terror, and his domestic economic policies. I think either way, regardless of the war on terror, in fact, I believe if the war in Iraq was not happening now, President Bush would have had a huge triumphant victory, maybe almost on the scale of Reagan in 84. It's very conceivable that could have happened, though the Iraq issue somewhat muddied the waters. And that's why John Kerry is able to gain some traction as, in some regards, the anti-war candidate. And regardless of that, regardless of his anti-war stance, both on domestic and international issues, President Bush was able to win this election decisively.
Both of you are going to Washington in the next couple of weeks, and one of the hot topics probably will continue to be Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. The president was resolute in standing behind him yesterday in the news conference he had. Congressman Price, you have seen Washington winds change drastically. Someone can have great support one day, and it can erode like the changing of a weather pattern. Would you think Don Rumsfeld will be Secretary of Defense a year from now?
That's a very hard prediction to make. I do not think Secretary Rumsfeld has accepted responsibility in a way that he should, and I don't think he's been held accountable by the president in the way that he should. And I think that goes back to the Abu Ghraib scandals and some of the issues relating to the interrogation practices, the treatment of prisoners, which have done so much damage to this country and to our cause in the Middle East, and now this absolutely indefensible comment to the serviceman about the continued failure of the Pentagon to armor these vehicles. I mean, this has gone on for well over a year. There have been directives in congressional appropriations to get that body armor out there, to get the vehicle armor out there. And especially the vehicle armor part of that has just not been managed. It's just another aspect of the mismanagement of this conflict, the inadequate planning, and so forth. Secretary Rumsfeld seems unable to accept responsibility. He just says stuff happens. And President Bush seems unwilling to hold him accountable. So normally you would think Rumsfeld would have been one of the cabinet members who might have been recycled here in this where about eight others have been. But given the way this president operates, I'm not sure that I would predict that.
Well, I mean, this is an area where we clearly disagree. I think Secretary Rumsfeld has done an admirable job of managing this conflict. I don't believe a year and a half ago or 2 years ago that anyone could foresee the level of insurgency that's in Iraq. Republican or Democrat, whether American or from any other country, could have foreseen the level of insurgency in Iraq. And regardless of that, Rumsfeld and the Department of Defense have been able to handle this conflict in a strong way and maintained order in 15 out of the 18 provinces in Iraq. And I think it's a strong showing for the just use of American force in the international realm. What they're doing is basically trying to target Bush's war policies in a different way by allowing Rumsfeld to be the embodiment of those policies. I think Rumsfeld has been a strong Secretary of Defense, has done a great job, and because of recent gaffes, if you'll call it that, people are piling on and trying to attempt to oust him from power. Actually, what happened was about a month after he was appointed Secretary of Defense, people started talking about him resigning, him being fired, and things of that sort, and now 4 years later, they're seeing a great opportunity to knock him off. And when it comes to armor...
I'll give you 10 more seconds. We've got to stop.
Certainly. Everybody's talking about these Humvees are supposed to be armored. Tanks are armored. Humvees are the modern-day Jeeps. They're there to carry individuals. So we need to have a better understanding of what is proper when it comes to armoring vehicles.
One last question to David Price. One of your colleagues from the House made the jump from the House to the Senate this past year, and Richard Burr. A caller that we couldn't get to wanted to know, would you consider running for the U.S. Senate?
Oh, I think probably I've cast my lot with the U.S. House, and I'm going to try to be part of getting the majority back there, I hope, in not too many years, and in the meantime try to exert some leadership myself there, and that's probably where I will stay.
Our thanks to Congressman David Price, a Democratic representative from North Carolina's 4th District. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Congressman Price.
Thank you.
And Patrick McHenry, the Republican Congressman-elect from the state's 10th District. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks so much, David, and pleasure talking with you, Congressman Price.
Same here.
And the book, The Congressional Experience, Transforming American Politics. If you enjoy politics, it's a good read. Following a long and contentious election season, most of us are enjoying a holiday season, free from campaign ads and debates. For some, however, the elections are still very fresh. For those still stuck in the election cycle, Raleigh News and Observer columnist Dennis Rogers has some advice.
Self-pitying liberals are moping around like somebody ran over their dog. Meanwhile, cocky conservatives are about one high five short of annoying. That leaves the rest of us, the much-maligned moderates. While everybody else is still picking at the carcass of the election that won't end, we're at home eating macaroni and cheese out of a box and wondering when that Ken Jennings fellow was ever going to lose on Jeopardy. It's lonely out here in the middle of the political road. While our two main political parties are careening further and further apart, we're trying not to get sucked into the vacuum they're leaving behind. Nobody loves us. There's no third party claiming our hard-to-label allegiance. What would the motto of such a party be? You could be right, but on the other hand? Instead of an elephant or a donkey as our party symbol, perhaps we should have a roadkill possum. Oh, it's not that we don't care. We really do. We're neither uninformed nor unconcerned, and we're not wafflers drifting from one position to the other. But neither do we march in lockstep. We just take a little pinch of this and a little pinch of that and make up our own minds. Now take guns. Now we're firm on this. We think some people should be allowed to own some kinds of them. Those who should not include people who are too stupid, too hot-headed, or too insistent. Sex education? We blush to admit it, but yes, there are a few things we're not too clear about. They include most of what we see on afternoon television talk shows, so be sure to let us know where to sign up for the latest sex ed classes. And will there be a final exam? The war on drugs. Our limited experience is that illegal drugs sold on street corners make you feel about the same as the legal ones sold in liquor stores. The first kind are illegal because people we don't like use them and they don't pay taxes. The second kind are legal because people we do like use them. Then they deduct them from their taxes as business expenses. Abortions. We think they should be performed only when absolutely necessary. We don't know when that is. Maybe God knows, so ask him or her. Flag burning. We think patriotism comes straight from the heart, while flags come straight from factories in China. You see our problem. The hot-button issues that cause sweaty people to expend so much money, time, and ego are just more things for us to fret over. Take the role of government in our lives. Liberals want to run things in our boardrooms where they have no ability. Conservatives want to run things in our bedrooms where they have no imagination. We think maybe it ought to be the other way around. Liberals want to save the world but use our money to do it. Conservatives want to rule the world and use our money to do it. We just wish real government was like the West Wing on television. Martin Sheen's our Captain Kangaroo. There is one thing we're almost certain of. There are probably more of us middle-of-the-road fence-sitters than there are wild-eyed true believers on either side. We're just too polite to endlessly whine or brag about it.
Dennis Rogers is a columnist for the Raleigh News and Observer. And that's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about our show, drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm David Crabtree.